by using a weapon. No. Then it's not bad, Tagok said. There is a certain type of person who feels like they must be armed at every moment of the day, or else the world will come for them in some way. Back home, this is very much not a good way to live. Here, however, outside of the base, it is the only way you are going to survive. We were at the Tanaka base, screened in shooting range on the jungle floor, standing at a table on which an array of weapons rested, their various magazines and cartridges and whatnot beside them. Some of them I recognized, a rather large number I did not. I pointed to one of them I did recognize, a handgun. Am I going to have to use one of these? Do you think it would work for you? I've never used one. Tagok nodded, picked up the handgun, checked it, loaded it, disengaged the safeties. This is a Glock 19, she said, and fired at a man-shaped target 10 yards down the range. I jumped at the noise and immediately heard ringing in my ears. How do you feel about it now? She asked me a minute later. Weren't we supposed to be wearing ear protection for this? I yelled. Wear ear protection in the jungle and you won't hear what's coming to eat you. Answer my question. I don't think I'm ready for that, I said. You're not, Tagok agreed. She reset the safeties and cleared the Glock and set it back down on the table. It's just as well. A handgun is not a very good weapon for this planet, or for most of the people who come to this base. It requires training and constant practice to maintain skill and accuracy. It's a short-range weapon, and here the range is shorter because the atmosphere is so thick. Bullets tumble fast here. Creatures move fast here. Most people are not very good at aiming at something close to them moving fast. She pointed to the Glock. If something on this planet is close enough to you that this is the weapon to use, you are likely already dead. If this is such a terrible weapon here, why did you show it to me? I asked. Because it's what you think of as a weapon, Tagok said. Not just you, everyone. You don't use weapons, but you see them used all the time in movies and TV and video games. Handguns and rifles mostly. She pointed to an assault rifle of some sort down the table. These are what you expect. These are what you think you want, even if you don't know it. You've been trained to think of these as the best weapons available. I need you to believe that there are better ones here. I cocked my head at Tagok. You do this a lot, I said, the whole I need you to believe this thing. I could just tell you, Tagok said. And at the end of me telling you, you would still want the handgun or the rifle. It's not just you. I have to break everyone of this. This world is not our world. I need you to believe that. The head and the heart thing again. Yes, you believe it or you die. Has that happened? People dying? Of course it has. And it's hard. Hard on the people here, especially hard on the people back home. Why? Because usually there is nothing left to ship back. I considered this. I don't mean to be disrespectful here, but you're not a lot of fun at parties, are you? I'm a fucking delight at parties, Tagok said, especially if there is karaoke involved. But this isn't the party. It's me trying to save your life and maybe help you save someone else's life. Now, are you ready to see what weapons I think you should use? Yes, please, I said. Good. She reached over and organized several objects on the table into a group. One I recognized as a shotgun. The rest were new to me. There are two basic definitions of a weapon. The first, and the one everyone uses, is an object that causes or inflicts pain or damage. The second, which is more relevant here, is an object one uses to defend oneself or gain an advantage. What do we know about the creatures here? They're horrible and want to eat every human they meet? Tagok shook her head. No. They're horrible, and they want to eat everything. Not just us, and not us first. They'll kill and eat us if we make ourselves convenient. But if we make something else more convenient, they're happy to eat them instead. So we do two things. Make ourselves less attractive to attack, and make it worth their while to attack other things. She pulled an object out of her pocket. You remember this. The ultrasonic thingy, I said. We call it the screamer, Tagok said. works on the tree crabs, and a few other things. You'll be getting your own. She pointed to a canister. This makes you smell like a particularly nasty kaiju parasite. And that's good, somehow? Since most things think you smell like a thing that will absolutely start to eat them while they're still alive? Yes. It means they will run in the other direction when they smell you coming. And what do the particularly nasty parasites I'll smell like think of me? They might leave you alone. They might see whether you want to mate. They might try to eat you. They eat their own? Everything here eats their own, including kaiju. That's not reassuring. Tagok nodded and reached for another object. That's why we have this. This launches canisters of actinides and stress pheromones that mimic those of injured prey creatures. It opens up on impact. If you see something coming for you, shoot this. At them? If you want. It's optional. It's not meant to kill them. It's meant to get their attention. It says, "I'm good to eat," in every native language here. They will forget you and go after it wherever it lands. So will everything else in the area. And then they'll all try to eat each other instead of me. You or anyone else in your party, yes. If I shoot it at them, then everything around will go after them, right? Do you think you're going to be that good of a shot? I see your point. Thank you. Okay, so, I pointed. Screamer. Parasite pheromones. Eat me launcher. All good. But what if they still keep coming? Tagok lifted a baton. You want me to hit them with a stick? She clicked a button on the stick. The stick comes with 50,000 volts. Okay, better. The charge doesn't last. If you can just beat them with the stick instead, do that. Things here feel pain just fine. Save the voltage for when you need it. And what about when a stick won't do? Tagok grimaced and picked up the shotgun. It had a short barrel. This is your last resort. Widespread, right out of the barrel, to compensate for your complete lack of aiming ability. It will kill almost anything at a short range, and at a longer range, the pheromone-dipped depleted uranium pellets in the shotgun shells will make anything hit but not killed smell like food to everything else. That and the blood. Don't even think about pointing it within 90 degrees of any human. This is the thing I will train you the hardest on. Fair enough, I said. And if this doesn't work, then you're dead. Oh, I was kind of hoping there'd be something else. Nope. Dead. Dragged into the jungle. Eaten and scavenged down to the bones, which will then also be eaten. Nothing will remain of you. At all. This is what I mean when I say I think you're no fun at parties. When you finish your training and survive your first mission on the jungle floor, you and I can sing Total Eclipse of the Heart as a duet at karaoke, Tagok said. Until then, you learn. She handed the shotgun to me. Let's start with this. The elevator finished rising, and I was surprised to find Aparna and Neve there. You need me for something? I asked. Not in the least, you egocentric monster, Neve said. They motioned at Tagok. We're here to see her. Neve and I were told to get ground training, Aparna said. We're going to help set cameras at the birthing site this next week. Is that so? I said. Then I turned back to Tagok, who was looking at both of them impassively. Be as thorough with them as you were with me, I said. The tone came out jokingly, but it wasn't joking at all. Yes, Tagok said. Then she looked at Aparna and Neve. We need to get you suits. Chapter 15. Here's the deal, Martin Satie said to us as we neared Bella's nest. I'll drop you off. You have 10 minutes to plant your instruments and do anything else you need to do. At 10 minutes, I'll be back at the landing zone. I'll come down and pick you up. You're not landing? Aparna asked. She and Neve were in the passenger area of the helicopter, along with Ioan Artelinu. I was in the co-pilot seat. Nominally, Artelinu was in charge of the mission, but in reality, he and I were along to be armed security for Aparna and Neve while they planted cameras and instrument packages. They were armed as well. Ryu Tagok gave them the same very basic weapons training I got a couple of days ahead of them, but not as heavily as Artelinu and I were. They had cameras and instruments to set up. "Dr. Chowdhury, I never land on the jungle floor if I can help it," Satie said. "It's a very good way to get those critters in your backseat. Now," he tapped his headset, "I'll keep a channel open, and I'm ready to come get you if you need an emergency extract. Please do not need an emergency extract. They're messy and dangerous. Come back to the landing zone instead. 10 minutes, that's all." "How do these things usually go?" Neve asked Satie. "Do you have to do a lot of emergency extractions?" "Not when people are smart," Satie said. "Every one of these is different. This is the first time I'm landing near a nuclear explosion site. This is the first time I'm landing near a nesting kaiju. Maybe those things don't make a difference. Maybe they change everything. I don't know. You don't know. Dr. Healy, Drs. Chowdhury and Artelinu, you don't know. And even this one," he pointed at me, "he is in the dark. When we get back, we get to write it up so everyone else can learn about it. Until then, however, we choose to be smart and not have an emergency extraction." "Mate, if that's your idea of a reassuring speech, you have work to do," Neve said. "It wasn't supposed to be reassuring, so that's all right," Satie nodded. "And here we are." We all looked out to see the mountain of Bella, roosting at the edge of the water-filled explosion crater. Around her was the mass of her natal jelly, and around that was a carpet of green, leading up and through the downed trees. A mat of moss and algae had grown aggressively on the previously scorched ground, a reminder that life here treated radiation much differently from back home. South and east of Bella, about 80 meters from her, was a small, flattish area, just big enough for Satie to drop us off. I looked at Bella as we came in. She appeared not to notice us. "Is she asleep, like Edward was?" I asked Satie. "Ask the experts," he said. "She's nesting and conserving her strength to make more eggs," Artelinu said. "Staying in one place makes it easy for her parasites to go feed and come back to her. Based on the behavior of other nesting kaiju over the years, unless we directly disturb her or she's otherwise in physical distress, she's not going to rouse herself or bother us or the helicopter." "If she does, you'll be walking home," Satie said. "It'll be fine," Artelinu assured us. He looked over to Aparna and Neve. "We just do it like we practiced yesterday. We'll be in and out and back home looking at the data." The two of them nodded at this. Our practice session the day before had been on the jungle floor directly below the base, with spots corresponding to where the aerostat pictures had suggested would be optimal places to put the cameras and instruments. Neve and Aparna got good at pounding in the stakes that the instruments would attach to and then popping on the clear domes of the camera and instrument packages themselves. I got better at moving around with both a shotgun and the canister launcher, either of which was literally a handful in itself. This, on top of the electrified baton and a bandolier that held shotgun shells, pheromone canisters, and various sprays. Neve had taken one look at the bandolier during practice and informed me that Chewbacca had called and wanted his clothes back. "Bringing us down," Satie said. We started our descent. "Remember, Jamie and I get out first," Artelinu said. "Then I'll signal you two, and you get the instrument packs out of the cargo hold. Jamie will signal Satie to lift off when you two have gotten everything and secured the hold." Aparna and Neve nodded at this. "It'll be fine," Artelinu repeated. The earth rose to meet us, and then Satie hovered inches above the ground. "This is it," he said, and nodded to me. "What's your step?" I nodded, took off my headset, and attached a much smaller headset, opened the door to jump out, exited, and slid hard on my ass. The moss and algae had made the ground slippery. I cracked my knee on the way down and cursed at the pain. I could hear Satie saying something to me through my new headset, but the racket of the rotors made it difficult to hear. I decided to ignore it and instead got up, carefully, retrieved my canister launcher and shotgun, switched over the safeties, then hobbled over to the passenger door. I pounded on it. Artelinu opened it up and got out. He'd seen me tumble and was more careful about putting his feet down before retrieving his own weapons. The two of us did a quick look-see and didn't see anything bounding up toward us. The copter was probably scaring the hell out of everything in a 100-meter radius. Artilini motioned to Aparna and Neve, who got out, carefully, and then went to the small cargo hold directly behind the passenger area, getting out the two large, soft-walled instrument bags that carried inside them two instrument packages, their stakes, and the embedding tool, which was a fancy name for a rubber mallet. The instrument packages were inside acrylic domes that looked like the sort you'd put cakes inside at a diner, but instead of cakes were several cameras and other scientific equipment. Neve and Aparna closed the cargo hold, gave me a thumbs up, and then we all moved away from the copter. Sati was waiting for my thumbs up. Once he saw it, he went straight up 100 meters and held position. "Watch out, it's slippery," Neve said to me through our headsets. I gave them a look. Then I turned to Aparna. "You, come with me," I said. "Safety first," Artilini said, and undid the compartment on his bandolier that held the parasite pheromone. "Screamers and spray." I nodded, got out my own spray, and then sprayed down Aparna while he did the same to Neve. Then I sprayed him, and he sprayed me. "We smell like fucking death," Neve said. "That's the point," Aparna reminded them. I put the spray back and got my screamer out of my pocket, turned it on, and put it back. I watched as Aparna did the same and gave a thumbs up to Artilini, who did the same once his and Neve's screamers were switched on as well. Artilini looked at his watch. "That was a minute," he said. "We did this in practice in 6 minutes. Let's be back here in 5:45. I saw Neve roll their eyes at this. They were not on board with striving for a personal best. But they went off with Artilini anyway. I looked at Aparna. "Ready?" "I'm not going to rush, if that's all right with you," she said. "That's fine," I reassured her. "Let's be quick, but not stupid." We walked in the direction opposite of Neve and Artilini, toward our first chosen spot, roughly 100 meters away. We walked carefully because the algae and moss weren't getting any less squishy as we went along. Our first destination was the farthest out because we wanted to work our way back in. As we walked, I kept an eye on the scenery, both at the landscape immediately around us, from which anything that might want to try to eat us would come from, and at the towering form of Bella. Walking around her was like walking around the Statue of Liberty, if the Statue of Liberty might at any second sprout wings and take to the sky. Aparna followed my gaze. "She's amazing, isn't she?" "Amazing is understating it." Aparna nodded. "It still doesn't feel real, does it? All of this." "Falling on my ass back there felt real," I assured her. "Yes, all right, fine," she said. "But the rest of it. We're standing where a nuclear explosion went off 2 weeks ago. The ground is slippery with life." She pointed off to the side of us where the natal jelly lay thick on the ground. I could see the eggs in it, spheroidal and the size of bowling balls. Vein-like growths came out of them and dissipated into the jelly. "There are things in that that will grow up into that," she pointed at Bella. "Who still shouldn't physically exist, if you ask me. And yet, here we are. Unreal." "You still think kaiju shouldn't exist physically?" I asked. I noticed around us things skittering about. The screamers and the parasite pheromones were doing their work, creating a bow wave of creatures determined to avoid us. Most of them at this point were insects and small lizardy creatures, none of which would have presented much of a threat to us. I suspected most of the real creature action was taking place in the natal jelly, where larger creatures were eating kaiju eggs and then being eaten by parasites in turn. Nature, red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson once said. Alternately, the circle of life, as Mufasa said. "I read the Precy," Aparna said. "The science checks out. It's just that it's so convoluted. The things that kaiju have to do to live is ridiculous." "You mean like organic nuclear reactors?" I prompted. I was having Aparna talk not just to have a conversation, but because I had an inkling that she was more on edge about this first away mission of hers than she was letting on. Having her talk would distract her from that. "Yeah, but that's just one thing. And it's not the weirdest thing. The weirdest thing is they have fans. I opened my mouth, as in to cool themselves. Not Comic-Con nerds, Jamie. I see you. I closed my mouth again, grinning. And the weirdest thing about that is that the fans aren't part of them. They're colonies of parasites. And then Aparna was off and running about how the parasites drew air into the kaiju and cooled off its internals, including the reactor, and how this was just barely enough heat exchange, and how the constant intake of air meant there was always a breeze around the kaiju, and how this constant air exchange made the kaiju one of the most important pollinators on this planet, and so on and so forth, and Aparna didn't even have time to be nervous as we walked. Until we got to where we planned to plant the first instrument pack, and found a stack of tree crabs scavenging a carcass just where we planned to plant the thing. Oh shit, Aparna said, pulling up. Keep walking, I said. We have our screamers on. They're going to scare them off as we get closer. And we did, most of them. They went skittering away as we drew up on them. But five tree crabs remained, policing the carcass, and Tene waving threateningly at us. I had been here before. But unlike before, I had now spent time under Riju Tagok's tutelage learning how to deal with the little fuckers. Which was, you march right up to them, grab them mid-carapace where they have a blind spot, and then chuck them hard and far. Which is what I did to the first one I came to before it had time to react. I hurled it, and it flew, chittering in alarm as it did. My crab-fighting skills were impeccable. Its fellows turned their antennae to follow its path into the air and back down again, and then turned their attention back to me. Who else wants some, I asked. In a movie, they would have all comically fled. In reality, I had to repeat the process of grabbing and chucking four more times. And then I had to pick up a rotted carcass and heave it some distance away so that if the tree crabs came back, they would bother the corpse, not us. I came away from the whole experience smelling even worse than I had before, which was saying something. I stood where we had planned to place the instrument package and made a ta-da motion. Whenever you're ready, Dr. Chowdhury, I said. Aparna shook herself out of motionlessness and swiftly got to work, unzipping her bag, pulling out the stake and mallet, and getting to installing the package. While she did that, I scanned the area, canister launcher in hand. If there was anything larger than a tree crab, it was not making itself known. The one advantage of walking around in a nuclear explosion debris field, if one wanted to call it an advantage, was that there was very little verticality. Nothing would be coming at us from above. It was one less dimension to worry about. Done, Aparna said, standing up. The instrument package stuck up a few inches from the ground. Its cameras were now at about the same height as a prone human. Is it sending? I asked. Aparna nodded and pointed to a green light on the package. Sending to the nearest aerostat and receiving, too. They're probably already getting the signal back at Tanaka. I waved to the package and then looked at my smartwatch. That took 4 minutes. Come on, let's plant the other one and get to the chopper. It's going well so far, Aparna said. Come on, Aparna, I said. Don't jinx it. Iwan Artelinu literally said, "That went better than I thought," before he slipped and fell on the moss and something the size of a panther came for him out of the natal jelly. We didn't see it coming. Artelinu was walking up from a small sloping hill and Neve was ahead of him on the climb. It's fair to say my and Aparna's attention was on Neve, not on Artelinu, on account that Neve was our friend, and also because it was Artelinu's role to be security, and thus to be secure. Unlike the rest of us, this wasn't his first time on an away mission. We thought he knew what he was doing. We weren't prepared for his slip, his fall, and then the creature bursting out of the jelly to come for him. Aparna and I were 20 meters away from Neve when it happened. They were, in turn, 10 meters ahead of Artelinu. We were close enough to Neve that they saw our expressions change and turned to see what happened. Neve had their baton out, as had Aparna. Once their instruments were planted, they were ready to assist in their own defense. This came in handy for Artelinu because Neve didn't waste any time. They sprinted to where he was, somehow not slipping and falling, and started whacking away at the creature that was now trying to yank Artelinu back down the slope toward the kaiju natal jelly. Aparna and I ran to assist. Neve's baton whacking had managed to dislodge the creature from the fallen biologist, and now it, apparently pissed, started making threatening movements toward Neve. Neve was not impressed and swung at the thing again, and this time there was a notable pop as an arc of voltage went from the baton to what passed for the creature's face. Neve had turned on the electric part of the baton. The creature backed off, rapidly shaking its face, but didn't retreat entirely. Aparna went to Artelinu and checked his wounds. I went to Neve, who was looking pissed and ready to get into it with the creature. "You okay?" I asked. "What? A stupid question to ask right now," Neve said, which meant yes, they were okay. The creature stood its ground several yards away, sizing us up. I shouted back to Aparna. "How is it?" "Left leg's torn up and bleeding," she said. "I'm fine," Artelinu said, and tried to get up. Aparna put a hand on his chest to keep him from moving. "He's really not fine, at all." I nodded at that and switched my headset over to Sati. "Chopper 2, come in." "You don't have to tell me, I see it," Sati said. "Coming to you for an emergency extract." "Thank you," I said. The creature started making a noise. "I think you should know there are more of those things on the way," Sati said. "I see them coming up through the jelly." "Got it," I said. I raised my canister launcher and, per instruction, launched a canister past the creature and into the natal jelly beyond, where it went off with an impressive poof and cloud of metal dust and pheromones. The creature looked back at the puff, and then slowly and decidedly back to us. "So that's not great," I said. I handed my shotgun to Neve. "If that thing moves, shoot it," I said. "Fucking obviously," they said. I went back to Aparna and Artelinu, who was still trying to get up. "I can move," he assured me. "Jesus, shut up," I said, and took his shotgun and canister launcher from him. "Pick one," I said to Aparna. She took the canister launcher. I reloaded my own canister launcher from my bandolier and then picked up the shotgun. "Chopper is coming to us," I told her. "I know," she said, and motioned up to her head. Sati was moving in position for descent. "I'm going to need help getting him into the helicopter." "I can do it," Artelinu said. "Shut up," we both said to him. "I'll send Neve back when he gets here," I said to Aparna. She nodded. I went back to Neve. "Fucker hasn't moved," Neve said. "No," I agreed. "It's waiting for backup." I pointed into the jelly, where several more of the creatures were making their way toward us. A few of them had gotten sidetracked by the delicious-smelling canister, but others were picking their way toward us. "Thank God we set up those instrument packages," Neve said. "Now, base can watch us get eaten in high definition." I nodded at this. "Go help Aparna with Artelinu," I said. The chopper was now close enough that it was about to drown out conversation. Neve dropped back, and I was now the only one standing in front of the creature. Two of its friends were now about 20 meters away, moving up on us slowly. I thought about my options, stowed the shotgun, and took out my canister launcher. The creature seemed to watch me do it, but otherwise did nothing, waiting on its friends to close in. I moved aggressively toward the creature, closing the meters between us and shouting as if to threaten it. Then I started to wobble on the thick moss and algae. This is what the creature was waiting for me to lose my balance, to distract myself, and to be defenseless. It opened its mouth wide, its scream lost inside the noise of the helicopter rotors, and hunched itself up to leap, which was what I was waiting for. My footing was just fine. I just faked out the creepy fucker, and now its mouth was open. I shot the canister directly into it. "Do you think you're going to be that good of a shot?" I remembered Ridu Tagok asking me when I asked about shooting a canister at a creature. As it happens, I still wasn't that great of a shot. But I was also shooting from a very, very close distance. The canister burst in the creature's mouth, going off like the grenade it was, knocking the already off-center creature back and toward its oncoming companions, who, once they got a whiff of their now stunned or dead pal, forgot all about me and decided their pal was an easier meal. Tagok was right. They'll eat us if we're convenient. So make it more convenient for them to eat something else. I suppose I could have used the shotgun to the same effect, but honestly, using the canister launcher was so much more satisfying. More of the creatures were picking their way out of the jelly toward their fallen comrade. I took that as my cue to take my leave. I walked back slowly to the helicopter, keeping situational awareness, until I was at the co-pilot's door. I opened it and got in. Satie took us up while I was still strapping myself in. "What did I say about not needing emergency extraction?" he said to me after I was buckled in and switched over my headset. "Sorry," I said. I looked back at the passenger compartment. Arlenu was on the floor, and Aparna was over him, cleaning out his wound with the antiseptic in the helicopter's first aid kit. "How is he?" I asked. "It looks pretty bad," Neve said. "Tell base we're going to need medical," I said to Sati. "I did that before I picked you up," he said. I looked over to Arlenu, who didn't have a headset on. He was saying something drowned out by the cabin noise. It looked like, "I'm fine." Aparna was ignoring him and treating him anyway. She was the sensible one here. I looked at Neve, who still looked pissed. We weren't all good, but we were all alive. I was going to take that as a win. I turned back to the front, looked out of the helicopter, and let out a long, shuddering breath. Satie noticed it, but didn't say anything. Until several minutes later, when his curiosity got the better of him. "Hey, I didn't get a good look at it," he said, "but did you actually just shoot one of those things in the face with a goddamn canister gun?" Chapter 16. When we arrived, we were greeted by a stretcher there to take Arlenu to medical. Tanaka Base had two doctors and two nurses, and one of the doctors, Irina Garin, was a surgeon. I suspected Arlenu might be visiting with her soon. He was efficiently removed from the helicopter and hustled off, decrying all the way that he was fine. Actually, really. "I'm glad he's safe now, but when he's better, I might punch him," Neve said, watching him go. "Seems fair," I said. "How are you?" I included Aparna in this. "How are both of you?" "I need a drink," Aparna said. "A drink?" Neve exclaimed. "I need several." Aparna smiled. "That's what I meant, but I didn't want to look like a drunk." "To hell with that! After today's adventure, I'm going to get smashed and wear a fucking lampshade as a hat." "Let me get the first round," I said. "After that, you will be responsible for your own lampshade procurement." We said goodbye to Satie and promised to buy him a drink when he was done, then walked up the tunnel to the base, where it turned out almost everyone was waiting for us, cheering. Kahurangi bounded out of the crowd and gave each of us a hug. "Thank you for not dying," he said. "What the hell?" I asked, looking around. "Mate, everyone saw the video of you three saving Arlenu." "Everyone?" "Well, it was a slow news day." I looked around. "Apparently." Kahurangi punched me affectionately on the shoulder. "Take the win, Jamie. Today, you three are heroes." He pushed me lightly into the waiting crowd. Aparna and Neve followed. Hugs and backslaps ensued. As it turns out, Neve was right. The cameras on the instrument packs were working, and, thanks to their positions, caught the attack on Arlenu and our defense of him from several angles. So did the aerostat, which provided a top-down view. All of these points of view were beamed back from the aerostat to Tanaka base in real time. Additional video from Sati's helicopter would add to it when it was transferred over. By the time we got back to base, we had become must-see TV. Everyone saw Aparna go to aid her fallen comrade, Neve zap the creature in the face, and me shoot it in the mouth. "I had to go to another planet to go viral," Aparna noted as we watched the video of the attack back at our own cottage. The three of us were told to take the afternoon off, and Kahurangi, presumably, was playing hooky. You're very famous to 150 people, Neve said to her. That's about the level of fame I would ever want. What were you thinking when you started beating the shit out of that thing? Kahurangi asked Neve. We were at the point in the video where Neve had gone ham on the creature, but not yet where they had zapped it. What does it look like? I was thinking. I was pissed. You have very deep wells of rage, my friend, Kahurangi observed. You have no idea. What about you? Kahurangi asked me. I was mostly thinking about how Sati was going to be annoyed with us, I said. He told us not to have an emergency, and then we went and had one. You didn't have it, Artelinu did. Kahurangi scrubbed back to the biologist falling on his ass and the creature leaping apparently out of nowhere to get at him. Dude, I slipped and fell, I said. It was the very first thing I did coming out of the helicopter. My knee still hurts. It was him that was attacked, but it could have been any of us. Not me, Neve piped in. No, your deep wells of rage would have rendered you absolutely immune to attack if you had fallen, I said. Bang on right they would. All our phones made notification noises. Aparna got to hers first. Update on Artelinu, she said. Muscle tears, but no ligaments torn or major blood vessels nicked. He's been given a full spectrum of antibiotics and a pair of crutches, and has been told no more field work for the rest of this tour. He'll be fine. Just like he kept saying, I noted. Neve narrowed their eyes. Don't you even. Sorry. Also, Aparna continued, after dinner tonight, there's going to be a special ceremony and party in our honor. The three of us, I mean. Sorry, Kahurangi. Kahurangi grinned. Considering what you had to do to get a party, I'm happy to miss out. What's the special ceremony about? Neve asked. Aparna looked back to the notice. It says we're to be inducted into the orders. Neve's brow furrowed. And what the actual hell do you think that means? From time to time, now and again, here and there, we find in our ranks people who do extraordinary things at extraordinary times, Bryn MacDonald was saying in the dining hall. She was at the table where she had just finished her dinner before standing up and literally yelling at everyone to shut up and pay attention to her. If this was part of the special ceremony, then it was deeply, deeply informal. And when that happens, what do we do? Induct them into the orders, came the general response. Yes, that's it. And today is one of those days, MacDonald continued. By now, I'm sure you've seen the video of Iuan Artelinu almost becoming a buffet, and then three of our newest Tanaka-based citizens coming to his rescue. To commemorate this event, it is time to make inductions. To begin, I yield the floor to my blue team counterpart, your friend and mine, Geneva Danso. There was applause as MacDonald sat and Danso rose from her own table. Our first induction of the evening goes to Iuan Artelinu, Danso said. She pointed to where Iuan Artelinu was sitting and made him stand, which he did with the help of his new crutches. She held something in her hand, which, on slightly closer inspection, revealed itself to be what looked like a cheap plastic medal on a ribbon. Our chief biologist has had 5 tours of duty here at Base Tanaka, and in his tenure has discovered, identified, and classified hundreds of the species of this planet. But, as we learned today, in all that time, the one thing he has not discovered is that any of the creatures he's identified and named will be happy to eat him. Laughs all around. And why not? Artelinu wasn't dead. It's easy to make jokes when you live. To commemorate his escape from the literal jaws of death, and to remind him to be more careful the next time, I'm proud to this evening induct Iuan into the ancient and sacred order of the Tasty Snack Cake. There was applause, and Danso walked over to Artelinu and placed the medal around his neck. and then gave him a peck on the cheek. "That's an ancient and sacred order?" I said to Kahurangi, who was sitting next to me at our table, as I applauded. "I'm guessing they make up the ancient and sacred orders as they go," he said. "Thank you, Geneva, and thank you, Tanaka Base," Adelinu said after the applause died down. "I am proud to be known as a legitimate snack." There were groans here of the sort that emanate when your dad uses slang he shouldn't. "And I also hope this is the last time anything sees me as such." More applause here. "But wait! Because, as it turns out, I am next to award an order. When I fell and was the subject of attempted consumption, once the very rude creature was removed from my leg, I was treated to the compassionate attention of Dr. Aparna Chowdhury, who first protected me from additional nibbling and then tended to me until we made it back to base. I remember telling her that I was fine, and I remember her response, which was, and I quote, 'Shut up.'" There were more laughs. "And as it turns out, she was right. I wasn't fine, and she knew it. I hate being the center of attention, even when it's because I was a tasty snack for a monster. But she kept me the center of her attention until I was safe at home. In recognition of her care of me, despite my attempts to pretend a shredded leg was no big deal, I am happy to award Dr. Chowdhury the ancient and sacred order of the very persistent nightingale. Aparna, you'll have to come to me. I'm still no good on my feet." The applause came up, and Aparna walked over quickly, got the cheap plastic medal and a hug, and then sat back down as quickly as she could. Being famous to 150 people was indeed her limit. Artelino negotiated himself back into his seat, and MacDonald stood up again. "Now it's my turn for an induction," she said. "Dr. Neve Healy has been with us for, Jesus, just 2 weeks. And yet anyone who has spent time with Dr. Healy in those 2 weeks has learned, and I'm willing to bet, appreciated their absolute intolerance for bullshit. So, when that parasite jumped on Iyuan, Dr. Healy did what Dr. Healy does, which is say, 'This is bullshit,' and then went to correct said bullshit with an electric baton." Applause here. "For their unwillingness to take crap either from humans or disgustingly large parasites, and their evident handiness with melee weapons, I am absolutely delighted to induct Dr. Healy into the ancient and sacred order of complete and utter bullshit." More applause, and Neve went over to get their medal and a hug. Neve turned to the assembled masses and held the medal up with their hand ribbon looping around their neck. "This is bullshit," Neve said. There was whooping and hollering as they sat back down. This was Tom Stevens's cue to stand up. "I believe I've told more than a few of you about how I recruited Jamie Gray," he said. "It involved food delivery and a last-minute need for someone to haul things around here on base." Laughs here. "So, I got lucky. But I think Jamie also got lucky. Who else among us, in their first 2 weeks, was chased by a kaiju, narrowly escaped a nuclear explosion, and then, as a capper, shot a parasite right in the face with a canister launcher? I mean, this is my third rotation, and I haven't done a single one of those." He looked at me. "I admit it, Jamie. I'm totally jealous." "You should be," I said. This got a laugh. "Anyone who has ever had weapons training with Ryu Tagak, which means all of us at this point, knows that her mantra with the weapons is, 'Do you really think you're going to do that?' And yet, here is Jamie, who, when confronted with a parasite that would happily eat everyone on that away party, marched right up to it, yelled at it, and then shot a canister right in its mouth. Right in the damn mouth, people. I am going to talk to Jamie about that, said Reed-Yu Tagok, somewhere in the dining hall. This got a huge laugh. And so, for coolness under pressure, for giving the rest of the away team the time it needed to get Yuan safely back to the helicopter, and for having the absolute nerve to ignore Reed-Yu Tagok, I am proud and happy to award Jamie Gray the ancient and sacred order of Holy shit, Jamie just shot that parasite straight in the mouth with a canister launcher. They're definitely making it up as they're going along, Kahurangi said to me. I grinned and got my medal and hug and thanked everyone. Then, McDonald declared it was officially party time, and music went up and people went to get drinks. I thanked people as they came by to congratulate me, and when that slowed down, I took a closer look at my medal. It had the words, World's Okayest Dad, on it, which, for many reasons, was not terribly accurate, but I knew it was the thought that counted. There was a firm tap on my shoulder. I turned and saw the impassive, unamused face of Reed-Yu Tagok. I can explain, I blurted out. This was a lie. I could not. Tagok held up a hand. Explanations later. We have other business tonight. We do? Yes, we do, Tagok said. Then she broke into a huge, toothy smile. Karaoke! And then the next day, everything was back to normal. Aparna and Neve went back to work, both of them going over the video and data from the instrument packages they'd planted. I think the thinking there was, inasmuch as they were attacked by creatures planting the instruments, they deserved to take the lead in working what came out of them. Likewise, I may have been inducted into the ancient and sacred order of whatever it was that I was inducted into, but also people still needed to have things delivered or removed or lifted, and I didn't need Val to think I was basking in my glory. The day after the party, people still gave me congratulations and told me the stories of their own inductions into the orders. The day after that, no one cared. Which was fine. It was a heavy burden being the world's okayest dad. I didn't need to be thinking about it every moment of the day. The day after that, I saw Tom coming up to me as I was coming out of the dining hall for lunch. He was holding his tablet as he came up to me. First off, this is not my fault, he said. That's a hell of an introduction, I said. We have our first tourists coming in a couple of days. Yes, I know. I had gotten the lists of the incoming VIPs for the next 3 weeks, and they were what I was assured was a pretty standard mix of military brass, political sightseers, and scientists who might actually have something useful to add to our work. There's been a last-minute change to this week's lineup. It literally just came in from Honda Base, who literally just got it from back home. Okay, so? They've swapped out Dr. Plate for one of our newer funders. All right, so I'm babysitting a billionaire. I'm familiar with the type. Well, that's the thing. Damn it, Tom, stop being vague. He handed me his tablet. Just remember, again, I had nothing to do with this. I took the tablet and read the revised visitor list. You have got to be fucking kidding me, I said. Chapter 17. The Shobijin slid into its dock, and immediately the Tanaka-based airship crew started to work on it, securing it and preparing to unload the various supplies that it carried as our lifeline to Honda Base and, therefore, the real world. Once emptied, it would be filled up again a little bit with scientific samples or things that we created at Tanaka that were requested by other bases, like canisters of specific kaiju pheromones. Tanaka was better equipped to make those than some other bases. Mostly, however, the Shobi Gym would be filled with the trash we couldn't treat, recycle, or compost. It would go back to Honda and then make it back to our Earth for proper disposal. It might seem fairly extravagant to airlift refuse and then send it through a dimensional door to get rid of it, but that was KPS for you. We took seriously the idea that we were to leave as little a mark on this world as possible. In a small change of pace, however, this trip, the Shobi Gin would be bringing trash into Tanaka. The gangway to Tanaka base was extended, and the door to the passenger compartment opened. Because this was mostly a cargo run, the passenger cabin of the Shobi Gin had been reconfigured, but there were still a few seats left for the tourists who had come to visit us. The first of these tourists finally appeared at the door and started down the gangway, followed by a second, and then a third, and apparently final tourist. Rob Shit Monkey Sanders, the former CEO of Food Mood. How the ever-loving Christ is he a tourist here? I had demanded of Tom the day before when he'd broken the news to me that Sanders was on his way. I don't know, Tom said. The only thing I can guess is that he spent some of those billions you said he got from selling Food Mood and gave them to KPS and they let him come over to see the place. So that's how it works? Shovel a couple of million to KPS and they let you pet the monsters? Well, yes, actually, Tom admitted. I gave him a look, which he noticed. This is how the game is played, Jamie. There's only so much governments can fund us before who we are and what we do becomes part of the public record. Getting money from the uber-rich, I see what you did there, is part of how we do our job and still keep this mostly under wraps. It's a sketchy way to get funding. Wait until you figure out that at least some of that billionaire funding is actually government funding, Tom said. They contract with the billionaire's company for a service on an expensive, no-bid contract, with the understanding that a cut of that revenue makes it here. Billionaires are laundering government money for us? Basically. I reiterate my amazement that this is all still somehow a secret, I said. Acknowledged, Tom said. And remember what I said the first time we ever talked about it. It's secret, but not that secret. He pointed at his tablet. Sometimes that means letting people we'd rather not in on the secret. Watching Rob Sanders now walking down the gangway, I leaned toward Tom, who was standing next to me, along with Bryn McDonald as part of the welcoming party. I can't promise I won't feed him to the tree crabs, I said. Resist the temptation, Tom suggested. It would be bad to feed our funders to the fauna. Maybe just parts of him? Jamie. Fine, I said. I will let him live. Today. The three tourists made their way to where we were standing, and McDonald greeted the first of them. Major General Tipton, she said. Welcome back to Tanaka Base. She nodded to Sanders and the other tourist. I understand you're running with half of your expected team at the moment. We are, he said. Dr. Gaines, who was with us from the Department of Energy, had a severe asthma attack after we crossed over to Honda Base. She's recuperating there in their medical facility, and the other two members of her team elected to stay with her. I hope she'll be all right. She'll be fine. They'll keep her people busy, I'm sure. Tipton motioned to Sanders and the other person on his team. Allow me to introduce Colonel David Jones, my aide, and this is Robert Sanders, who is here representing Tensorial, one of our major contractors.